Author of the Week, featuring another great creator of narratives for the human race on Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio.
Christian fantasy has arguably been around for thousands of years in a range of sort of aspects, etc. But certainly in the 20th century, it was probably C.S. Lewis who really actually brought it to the fore with, of course, his epic Chronicles of Narnia series. Here we are in the 21st century, and of course we've got another Chronicle series which also falls under the bedrock of possibly Christian fantasy. Book four, of course, has just been released, the penultimate in the saga, and we're delighted to actually welcome the author and creator of the Eternal Chronicles, and indeed Eternity's Edge, Zachary Hagen. How are you, Zachary?
I'm just fine. Thank you so much for having me today.
So it's great to connect with a good self. Now, let's start off with a little bit of definition time, basically, because I always like to start off the introductions by let's try and attempt, even if we don't succeed, to define this wonderful concept of Christian fantasy and so on and science fantasy. What, in your own words or thoughts, would the Eternal Chronicles series fit into?
I think that it fits very squarely into that Christian fantasy realm, but there are definitely elements of science fiction and urban fantasy with it. And I think it's because, you know, there's a lot of elements that I draw from different pockets of their genres, but the core of the story is about faith and growth and becoming the people that we are meant to be.
So we mentioned Charles Staples Lewis, of course. It would be remiss of us not to actually refer to his fellow inkling, J.R.R. Tolkien, who actually once claimed that, as far as he was concerned, Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe was a hodgepodge, and he wasn't a fan of it at all in so many ways. I mean, ironic, given, of course, the Christian ethos that sort of permeates both texts in many ways. Although I still get students even today who somehow are taken aback when the Christian metaphor and analogy to obviously the New Testament and the salvation concept is actually brought to the fore. So I myself probably, when I first read it, didn't really make those connections. And it's only with later readings that you begin to deliver and discover that. Is that something which, you know, in a sense, first and foremost, it's got to be a really good plot, has got to have a really good tale. If by some divine inspiration a Christian message can also be developed and enhanced within that, then that's a lot easier to actually cope with.
I think so. And I've had the same experience. I think that the more I read the Chronicles of Narnia, especially, the more layers are peeled back, especially. And when I was a kid, it was The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe that was my favorite. But I think as an adult, it's become The Horse and His Boy for the relational aspects between how Aslan and Shasta interact, almost skirting around each other for most of the book until they finally come into contact in the mountains of Arkenland. And that particular thing was a big inspiration in writing my own books.
So you weren't going to mention the last battle then, often put to the side, etc. I mean, again, Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe certainly, again, had a residence and connection. It's usually the go-to book. Again, I'm not going to spend too much time talking about it, but fascinated to see the Narnia Code. People have actually related to the whole notion of how, obviously, Lewis's interest in medieval scholarship and writing in that center of the universe attention also echoes within the books. And, of course, probably the most anachronous aspect, which readers, I think, even today tend to find they have difficulty with, and obviously Tolkien did, which is the appearance of Father Christmas in Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, in terms of what, where, purely and simply. And I think there is a slight case for saying, if it's set in Narnia and you have Aslan, surely it should be Aslanmas as opposed to Christmas, in terms of the actual name that's actually there, because, you know, the Christ epic wouldn't necessarily have crossed over there. Again, you could look at these days, multiple dimensions and alternate realities from that point of view. But that was, again, an interesting one. But we're not here to talk about C.S. Lewis, much as we could have lots of fun doing so. We want to focus on your own work and Eternity's Well, Eternity's Refuge. Again, the entire series from that point of view. Defined by the serial reader as a bold and delightful opening into a fantasy series that's worth following. It's very much focused at the young adult level from that perspective. So again, is it one that basically ideally Eternity's Edge is book four, but in an ideal world you should start with book one and work your way through it? Or is it a bit like Lewis's line, where actually Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe technically is the second in the series?
I think that it makes the most sense if you start from the beginning. In this case, with C.S. Lewis, of course, he wrote The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe first, and then went back and wrote The Magician's Nephew. And you can read his books chronologically, or you can read them in the release order, and they'll still make sense because not all of the stories deal with the exact same characters. With The Eternal Chronicles, the same set of characters with the addition of one, or I guess the swapping of one for another between books one and two, really drive the story. So it's very character driven, particularly with Elior, the main character. The readers will stay with him through the whole time. So I think that starting with like book three would be very out of place. And if you went back and read book one from book three, Elior wouldn't make any sense because he's, frankly, in book one, he's a little bit whiny and immature. But by book four and five, he's grown into himself quite a bit. And he's a very different person than he was on page one of book one.
Book four, of course, Eternity's Edge. Civil War is the beginning of the end, but who will survive? I mean, it's a sad reflection in so many ways on us as a human species. But frequently, I think the creator might sort of just be possibly sort of with a decent sense of humor saying, "What? What?" But that notion of conflict, which is obviously the essence of drama, etc. When people hear that line of Christian fantasy, they often tend to think, I suspect, oh, it's going to be a nice twee, lovely sort of soft scenario for that point, which, of course, as we've just said, Tolkien, Lewis, anything but in many ways. Is that something else that you've preferred to actually, give it an edge? And actually, as you see the development of Elior and his friends, etc., and Tariq, etc., Viola, that actually you are looking at ensuring that you have got, a little bit of conflict that's actually in there, which adds to the spice of the novel.
Oh, absolutely. There's political intrigue. There's romances gone awry. There's a myriad of conflicts in the books. And by necessity, I mean, readers who are familiar with the Bible and not the Sunday school or Sabbath school version of it, where it's just the characters going about and then God saved them and yay. The Bible's full of drama and full of blood and gore and violence and political intrigue, and life is full of those things. And I think that even fantasy needs a sense of reality. And I wasn't trying to make a fluff piece just to endorse my own faith. It needed to feel like a real story with real relatable characters that experienced faith and growth in a real and tangible way.
The current state of affairs in the world is, as some might say, ever packed with challenges about people's beliefs, people's faiths, people's arguing for a particular aspect of land, and so on and so forth. Do you feel there's a flaw in the human character, or is this a case of where, if we actually do take on board the Christian message, if we do actually acknowledge the fact that that whole way, the route that in a sense divine paradox that you have, the creator of the universe becoming human and the salvation scenario. Do you feel that's something which people have, in many ways, arguably lost their way, and so as a result of that, that's one of the reasons we do have so many challenges and so many people who are confused, lost, and frankly, there's an awful lot of fear that is then peddled around in terms of how people actually relate to their current presidential candidate or forthcoming presidential candidates.
It's that's such a an interesting question, and I have to thank you for such deep questions to answer because I love academics and pulling things apart. I'm actually in a doctoral program studying myself right now, and I recently read an article that kind of touched on this, and it was about contemplative pedagogy. And one of the ideas was about how the human state of being is one in relation to God, where we are at conflict between a craving for community and a craving for autonomy. And I think a lot of those conflicts can be summed up in that way. Where is that balance struck, and where is the victory in that? And I think that obviously, since I am a devout Christian, I think that the balance is that there is freedom and true autonomy apart from the slavery to sin, apart from the slavery to self, and embracing the reality and the nature that God initially created us with. So I do think that in large part, a lot of the conflicts that we experience in the world are because we don't know where that balance between freedom and community and unity with each other, within ourselves, and with God is. And it's a struggle to figure out where that is. And a lot of people don't even want to acknowledge the existence of God because they're so focused on what they want that they don't realize that they're miserable in it.
And perhaps we forget that actually it is the good news that actually was brought, and the emphasis on good from that point of
Yes.
view. I mean, I often find that the tale of the wineskins, new wine in old skins, doesn't necessarily work. You have to actually rethink that. Oftentimes, I think people, possibly for understandable reasons, if they've had a very negative experience as a child or in a family that hasn't kind of connected and has actually seen the wrath of the Old Testament or the perception of that, tend to often be very confused, and they forget that actually, the whole thing holistically is really a basic instruction booklet for the life experience in many ways. The whole sort of collection of books and lines that are within that. Okay, let's return to some more prosaic questions then. You have obviously a wonderful partner and wife, Claudia. In addition to that, you've also got a fabulous dog called Flynn. How do you relax?
That's a great question. Right now, I'm not really sure. I think right now we are in a stage of life where we're working very hard and making sacrifices so that we can, in a few years, relax. I mean, there are moments where we'll sit down and watch a movie. I'll read, of course. Writing is very therapeutic for me, but in a lot of ways, we're still in our early life, in our mid to late 20s, and still establishing ourselves in our professional careers. And so I guess the answer
And
is
you've got eternity, so there's no rush. There is eternity on that sort of basis. So, it's worth working through that. And one of the questions we often put to author Zachary is related to music. And some authors actually have a set playlist that they like to go to that they are basically keen to use to inspire. Some prefer all lyric-free music, so they don't like to have any lyrics there, which might distract them from the whole thing. Others have a particularly different take. Some prefer absolute silence. Do you have any particular technique that involves music or that relates to it? I mean, or a case of, well, I have to actually listen to the full soundtrack to The Fellowship of the Ring to really get myself into the mood.
Oh, goodness. I can listen to pretty much anything that's non-lyrical. I was a vocal music education major in my bachelor's degree. And so if I start listening to anything with lyrics, I'm going to start thinking about technique and I'm not going to be writing anymore. I can have enough disconnection from other instruments, even though I played a lot of them, that especially if it's orchestral or a combination of different things, I can actually concentrate on what I'm doing. So typically, it's either a movie soundtrack without lyrics or some kind of ambiance sort of structured writing sprint video on YouTube that has both music and sort of ambient noise with it. In particular, because I do a lot of the writing in my office, it gets so quiet that I can't concentrate. So I need something, music and some ambient noise that definitely helps me to kind of zone out of my environment and get into the word.
Yes, it seems Beethoven still is very popular with writers. Just actually listening to classical music from that point of view. Philip Glass, I think, ironically from the more contemporary area, has also proved to be quite popular in terms of his whole system. But yeah, again, and maybe even Jean-Michel Jarre, who I always feel is a underrated French solo, who obviously has produced a whole range of material. But by the by, where is home, Zachary? Where are you sort of based full time?
Currently, my wife and I live in Mississippi, but we are actually looking to relocate for her career. So we will likely be somewhere else in the next 4 to 5 months. Right now it's Mississippi.
It's a long river, Mississippi, obviously, and a long sort of spelling, so you can move along there or move to a completely different other places. We had hoped to be joined. I think she popped in briefly, but obviously she was in transit from one of our regular correspondents, Jessica Burtis, who is located in North Carolina. So again, that's again with a wealth of other sort of aspects. Okay, let's move on to fandom, because one thing's about science fiction, fantasy in all sorts of ways, is it does generate a passionate following, and I'm sure that the Eternities sequel will certainly already have that side of things there. Do you get an interaction, or do you interact with the sort of fans of the series? Is it a case of you will take a wry smile and say, "Okay, that's interesting," from that point of view? In terms of ownership of characters, do you actually feel that, they speak to you, they have a you have an ownership, etc.? Or is it rather like the classic authorial notion that once you've actually written the book, once you've put it out there, basically it's up to the audience to determine how they kind of relate to this to the adventures themselves?
I wouldn't say, I think maybe it's somewhere in between. I don't feel like the characters are completely mine because, I mean, I believe that the creative gift is a gift from God. And so I think that Elior, in a way, is something that God wanted out there, regardless of whether I wrote this specific story or not. I think that it would have gotten out one way or another. But I don't think it's entirely up to the audience to determine exactly how they interpret the book because, or the book series, because it does have a particular message and meaning. And I think they can determine certain actions any way they want. But the overall theming and structure of the book is set to tell a particular story.
And no connection whatsoever between Elior and the synonym Elijah in terms of the book.
Oh,
Or is
there's a
there?
lot in there. Yes. All the members of the royal family of Vidania, all the male members of that family, their names start with an EL. So at the beginning of the series, the king of Vidania, who was dethroned, was Eliezer. Elior's name was Ilium. And there are a couple other names that I mentioned throughout the series, but they're kind of a one-off because they're so background that I don't remember. But even the female members all have E names, and it is because of the L connection with Elijah, Elisha, and the meaning behind that.
And of course, the option of possibly going down the line of Saul, David, and Solomon will be a whole new text and a whole new series, no doubt, with all
Oh,
sorts of other
yes.
strange things.
Yes. If the series ever gets enough demand, I would love to write further books set in the history of the world. But right now, Eternity's End, which will be coming out this summer, will be the last one for a while.
You mentioned obviously you're doing a PhD. You also, of course, are involved with respect to your creative writing and so on. We talked about relaxing aspects, etc. What about reading authors that you particularly? I mean, we've talked about Lewis, we've talked about Tolkien, etc. Any current or contemporary writers that you would say actually they do connect? They manage to sort of connect with us. I mean, obviously, I'm conscious that you've got a fantasy series there. there was an awful lot of controversy for understandable reasons about our J.K. Rowling and her kind of viewpoint with respect to the wizarding scenario from that point of view. And again, a lot of emotions went high with respect to that. I don't think it's necessarily determining a sort of an anti-Christ version of that. But are there any writers that you tend to think, yeah, actually, they do produce some good work?
So within my own genre, I really have enjoyed, oh goodness, her name is escaping me right now. I'll come back to her, but some dystopian authors that I've enjoyed, Natalie Camerata. She's another smaller author right now. Fantastic writing. Christopher Paolini, I've enjoyed, Suzanne Collins. Rick Riordan's work with mythology was really interesting.
It's interesting you mentioned Suzanne Collins there, because although I don't think there's any real explicit Christian line that comes across in The Hunger Games, it's very much a kind of tale of a dystopian world in terms of which there's a lack of faith and a lack of belief, or indeed there are a whole range of false gods that are actually in there.
It's an interesting sort of parallel, and a lot of people I think wouldn't necessarily see the political and religious ties to those sorts of things. I mean, they think it's just, oh, it's a dystopian world and it's a dictatorship and they're going to throw it over. But there are a lot of parallels to our world today. I mean, if you look at things like the Met Gala, you can't help but think of the way that the people in the Capitol were described. And I think a lot of the upper echelon of celebrities and their patrons are very disconnected from the reality experienced by the rest of us. So there's definitely parallels there.
Speaking of which, of course, I'm sure that it'll only be a matter of time before various Hollywood producers come tap, tap, tapping and saying, oh, we'd quite like to actually take this and maybe produce a series and develop their celibate pieces. Is that something which you have consciously looked at, some of the multimedia applications, the obviously the audiobooks, interactive video games or the interactive media games, etc., and of course that staple certainly, the notion of a motion picture series?
I've toyed with the idea. I think that the series so far is successful with a small group. I think that in order for it to get that kind of attention, I'm going to have to really work on developing the readership there, which is entirely possible. A lot of smaller authors aren't really successful until their 20th book. And so I'm a quarter of the way there. Of course I've thought about it. I've written part of a screenplay for the first book. I think that if that ever happened, I would definitely have similar demands to J.K. Rowling with her Harry Potter books. And how involved she was in the creation of the movie series. And the reason why it's probably one of the better done movie series in relation to how well they followed the books. And they weren't even perfect, but of course you have to make changes when you're going from one medium to another, is because of her involvement. So I would have very similar demands because I think that fans of a book series in particular deserve to see that story preserved and the core of it unchanged.
It's again almost a no-brainer how often we've seen a situation whereby the successful franchises, the successful movies, have actually benefited from the fact that they've stayed fairly faithful to the actual original writing, as opposed to literally taking the title and then doing something completely differently. I mean, there is an example. I suppose you could argue that what Ridley Scott did with Blade Runner, as he adapted Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, was successful, but it was a different, in a sense, a different animal, and indeed had a different name, even though the original text was taken onto that. So interesting from that. We
And there
talked
are
about C.S. Lewis. We talked about obviously Tolkien up to a point. Both, of course, well, South Africa and UK based authors from that perspective in terms of their origins, both UK. Where would you position Mark Twain?
Mark
I
Twain,
mentioned it because of the Mississippi connection,
yes,
obviously.
he's, I think that he's a He's a squarely American author.
Yeah.
But of course, at that time in American history, there was still a lot of, particularly in the South, influence from European culture. I mean, you can even still see it in a lot of ways in the South with our architecture and the Southern drawl being much closer to a Cockney accent than it is to a Boston accent. Or not a Boston, maybe New York, because of the absence of the hard R sound. So I think that much of American culture has stemmed from our roots in Europe and has just grown into something different because of the distance. So I don't know,
I
maybe
raised Twain not
that's.
only because of Mississippi, but also because of obviously a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. I think is a fabulous sort of example, and arguably one of the earliest examples of time travel being used in literature as a populist mode. Although it is time travel via a dream state, and
Right.
certainly an interesting line on that side of things there. Advice, Zachary, young writers, young authors who might be listening to this particular piece. And they're thinking, oh, I want to be like Zachary, etc. What would you do? What advice would you give anybody who actually says, okay, I've got this story. I feel as though it might, I might feel that I'm being inspired to tell this story. What should I actually do? Should I go and hide it away, or should I actually get out there and write it?
I think that you have to get out there and write it. And the hardest part of being an author is getting that first book done, learning what your process is, learning how to actually put out a large work, because any book, I mean, the minimum number of words for a novel is typically considered about 50,000 words, and that can feel very daunting. So having writing goals, knowing whether or not you need to have the entire book planned out before you start, and things like that are really helpful. For me, I plot out my books in relative detail before I start writing. At least I have all the major main ideas of the chapters, and then as I go, I'll add details for scenes before I start writing a chapter. But I know the end before I begin, and I think that that's really helped me.
Yeah, again, sometimes it's seen as counterintuitive that you actually have an end point in mind or an end goal, and then you worry about how you're going to get there. But actually, again, it's an interesting line in terms of how that's developed from that point of view. Any thoughts about prequels? I mean, obviously, as you said, the latest one, Eternity's Edge, is the penultimate in the Eternal Chronicles series. But the very name itself, surely Eternal, suggests that there might well be a kind of prequel, possibly indeed sequels as well.
I'm definitely open to it. I have a few titles that I could go back to. One that I would love to write at some point would be Eternity's Assassin, which is a story about David, or an allegory of David's life becoming king. And so he would be the first line of the kings that
He started off
Eliar.
so well, and then he basically went all over the place with respect to challenges and such. Never mind.
Good.
It's just another line. And favorite characters. I mean, is Elior your favorite character from the actual Eternity series, or do you have a liking for Tariq or Viola or others as well?
You know, in a sort of morbid way, I do love Tariq because he is so coy and cold and calculating in the first book, but he sort of devolved into complete madness as the series has gone on. And he's just grasping at straws, trying everything he can to survive. And a cornered animal is terrifying. Because they're on their last legs. They have nowhere else to go. And so they're going to fight tooth and nail. So there's a certain fear and respect I have for Tariq, and he's fun to write. But Elior is very much who I would consider the embodiment of humanity. There's growth and there's space for reflection. But there's also deep sorrow and loss that he copes with. And so I love them both for different reasons. And they are not even equal opposites. Tariq is much more powerful, but it's in Elior's weakness and need for Michael and the Great Spirit that I think that the true value of his character is found.
As you were discussing Tariq there, I must admit I was thinking, yeah, actually that is another key aspect of this particular genre, where whether it's Gollum in the Lord of the Rings, or whether it's arguably Edmund in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, you have the flawed character, the not necessarily the villain, and certainly not the anti-hero, but the person who's basically suffering because of a lot of their own self challenges that build in there, and again needs to work through that particular aspect. Internationally, of course, global market, are there any particular countries that you think, yeah, actually I'd quite like to travel to Australia and push the joys of the Eternity series, etc., or maybe Mozambique or wherever.
I think definitely I would love to travel to the UK and Australia. Australia, because a lot of the shape and terrain of how I kind of design the world, I kind of think is closer to Australia than it is to North America, thinking about it. And the UK, because C.S. Lewis and my desire to honor his memory by writing something that I think he would have approved of definitely was a big instigation for this series.
And we started with Lewis. Let's begin to conclude with respect to Lewis. As we said, he wrote more than just the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, or the Chronicles of Narnia. In fact, that was towards the latter end of his life in many ways. And I always thought it was quite fascinating that he passed on the same day as John F. Kennedy was assassinated, basically in 1963. Lost Lewis, and obviously Kennedy as well at that side of things. Do you feel as though the legacy of Lewis has rightly been reappraised, and that whereas he was often seen as, shall we say, second best to Tolkien, probably erroneously, he might have actually argued against that, but maybe, as I say, his considered a viewpoint and take on the world, and in particular the Screwtape Letters. I mean, I'm looking at obviously his non Narnia work, but his work where he really did begin to embrace Christianity in a way that he hadn't earlier, that in many ways the line that Tolkien effectively produced the logical argument that if not converted, effectively set Lewis on the path to acknowledging that, yeah, there is a greater being, a greater line from that point of view, which again he argued very solidly for, very capable, especially given, of course, his own circumstances and tragic circumstances, both with his parental loss and, of course, partner loss later in life.
I feel like I kind of lost the question there. Could
Yes, no,
you?
I thought you might. I'm just saying, in terms of that whole essence of Lewis, do you feel that actually, as we head through the 21st century, and it's astounding to think we're almost a quarter of the way through it, that legacy of Lewis will actually be, it'll shine out more than shall we say, he did very positively during the 20th century as a contemporary of Tolkien's, but obviously that message, will continue in many ways through eternity.
Yeah, I think that C.S. Lewis, I think in the secular space, that it would be hard to rival Tolkien because Tolkien's works are so ubiquitous to the fantasy space, whereas Lewis is maybe a little bit off on the side, but I think that his impact might be quieter but bigger, sort of like an iceberg. The bulk of it is under the surface where you don't necessarily see it or understand its vastness, because people who first read the Chronicles of Narnia and want to read more C.S. Lewis will go to things like the Screwtape Letters, and maybe that'll pull them into Mere Christianity or The Great Divorce or any of his other writings, which are inextricably tied to his faith, regardless of what it was. Well, with exception to his academic writing, that's a little bit drier and much more focused on the medieval time period, of course. But I think that the impact, because C.S. Lewis is so easy to read, and it feels like you're returning to a friend, that the impact of his writing may be greater than Tolkien's. Even maybe that's blasphemy, but it may
Well
be.
said, well said. Zachary, how can people actually follow you via the social media? Do you have a particular presence on Instagram, TikTok, or is it a case of no, just write to me directly?
I'm working on the social media aspect. I am on TikTok and Instagram. I haven't posted in a while. I'm trying to get better at that. But my website is ZacharyHaganWrites.com, and the links for all my social media are on there. And I'm trying to get a blog up and running in the next year or so.
Well, that brings us to two final questions. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us today? Has it been good for you?
Oh, it's been wonderful. I've really enjoyed the questions.
Excellent. Well, the final question from our point of view then is, can we prevail upon you to join us again in the not too distant future, not at the end of eternity, hopefully in the not too distant future sometime later in the year? Will you come back?
I would love to. Let's try to get something put together for this summer.
thought for once we might be having some good news, especially when we actually start considering the importance of childcare and so on. And to explain why the good news is going to be forthcoming and the importance, obviously, of childcare, we're delighted to welcome child psychologist extraordinaire Laverne Antrobus. How are you, Laverne?
I'm very well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to connect with your good self. And I think it's, I mean, let's jump straight into the whole process. A new campaign, which is piloting out from that point of view, £1,000 sign-up bonus, and it's all to do with childcare recruitment.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's an opportunity to do something big, as we're saying, you know, for people out there who might be considering a career change to become an early years practitioner. I mean, some of the evidence that we have for this is from the Department of Education's survey of people who were saying to us, parents who were saying, actually, I am considering, you know, 61%, I am considering a new career. And given the importance of childcare, and really it's at the heart of, you know, part of how my job has sort of found itself out there, you know, early years work is phenomenally important. And that's really the message we want to get across.
So allowing for that and the crucial aspects that early year care can actually have for children, how do you think this campaign is going to actually help that? I mean, is it just a case of it's more than a cash incentive, although that obviously helps?
I think it's definitely more than a cash incentive. I think that it's really important that if people are hearing about this, you know, our intention is that people will hear about this and get interested. You know, perhaps they're thinking, as I said, about a career change, but perhaps they're thinking, could that be me? And actually, that's what we want, because I believe that this is a pivotal role that people take on. If you love children, if you love to see their development, if you love to see them grow and learn, and you're up for a bit of a challenge, I think this could be for you. And so that's really at the heart of this campaign. If you hear about it, have a look and see if this might be you.
What are the key skills that people actually need to actually become a childcare person? I mean, presumably it's more than just listening or actually running for emergency services if required.
I think that's absolutely right. I think you have to have a love of children. You know, you have to be really interested in their development. We've got to have quite a lot of patience. You know, that's definitely got to be in the mix. But I suppose you've got to really enjoy being in their company, seeing them grow, you know, being part of this part of their life where they're putting those skills together. I've often been in nurseries and observed early year practitioners, and the sort of joy as they see children come through a developmental stage. You know, 2 days ago, they were having a bit of an outburst, but 2 days later, they've really learned how to control and manage their emotions. And, you know, the interaction that I observe between the earlier practitioner and the child is so joyous. And I think at the heart of this, Alex, is that we are trying to recruit people who really can put together a sort of balance of care and learning. You know, that actually we want children to enter the education system feeling that adults are caring, they're safe people to be around, and they're interested in them. And I believe that that's at the heart of this work.
There may be people listening to this, Laverne, who are saying, well, that's all well and good, but surely we have the technology now with AI and other such things to actually say, simply put the child in the hands of some artificial intelligence robotic form and the system will be all sorted through. Would you, I presume, disagree with that? And if so, is it important that that human connection is still maintained?
I think you sort of answered it, really. You know, I think you cannot get past the human connection, and particularly for children at this age. I think AI probably has a really important place when some of the fundamental skills have been achieved. You know, what we want to see is that children being brought to nurseries or their childcare placement by their parents can leave their parents well, can be sort of handed over to another adult who they can trust for that day. You know, so there we have it, Alex. We have children developing relationships with people outside of their family home. And if we get those sorts of parts of their work, their world sort of in sync, that's the rollout for life, really. So in a way, I'm speaking to those people out there who are thinking, this sounds like me. You know, I'm somebody who really loves relationships, you know, having a career where relationships is really important and loves young children.
DSB, do something big. Of course, that's at the heart of the whole thing, the whole process. Where can people actually go to find out further details about Do Something Big and indeed the Early Years Career Campaign?
if anybody has listened and this has sort of caught their imagination and they're thinking, yeah, this might be for me, then go to the website, which is www.earlyyearscareers.campaign.gov.uk.
And just finally, Laverne, is this something which you feel it has been lacking for many years, and finally politicians have actually got their finger out and actually are providing at least some help in terms of doing this? Or do you think as though, we can always do with more?
I think it's been, I think for early years practitioners, their role has been a bit asleep in people's minds. I mean, that's why I'm so excited to be involved, because, another stat from the DfE is that 3/4 of parents, 74%, they recognise that the person who was involved in their child's life at this stage, the early years practitioner, is a bit of a superhero. So I think parents have always known that these individuals are fundamental to how their children develop and grow. I think if we can get society as a whole to really recognise it and tune in to the fact that if we give children this good start, then really we lay the foundations for later life. It's been a bit asleep, but here we are waking it up.
Well, there we are. You see, sleepy time, always good. Laverne Antrobus, huge thanks. And hopefully we'll speak again very soon.
Thanks, Alex.